Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning, Ramona Koval here. It's time for the book show on ABC Radio National. Shortly, New York-based Australian biographer Hazel Rowley joins us to speak about the celebrations in France all this year, marking 100 years since the birth of writer, feminist and philosopher Simone de Beauvoir. And do you know how many steps it takes to cross the road or how many stairs you have to climb to get to your flat? Are you a counter? I am, actually. And later we talk about people who are passionate about numbers to the point of obsession. And we're going to meet two people who've written about this. And we continue our first-person reading of Pamela Bohn's memoir, Bad Hair Days. So, this year marks the centenary of the birth of Simone de Beauvoir, French feminist philosopher and writer who, together with her lifetime lover Jean-Paul Sartre, made a huge contribution to the history of ideas in the 20th century. She died in 1986, but with the publication of her 1949 book The Second Sex, she changed the way women thought about being women and more or less wrote a manifesto for the development of what would become the women's movement. So how are the French celebrating the life and work of this woman? Well, as you'd expect, there are all kinds of conferences, but also the Nouvelle Observateur put a picture of her bottom taken in the early 1950s on its cover. A very nice bottom it was too at the time, but there have been some French eyebrows raised over this bottom. Biographer Hazel Rowley wrote the book Tête-à-Tête, which analysed the relationship between Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre. She spoke to us on the book show when it was published, and who better to speak to us now than Hazel? Welcome to the book show from New York, Hazel.
Thank you, Ramona.
Well, you've just come back from Paris, I understand, where you were part of the celebration. So what is being organised? What did you see around the life and work of Simone?
Well, the big thing has happened. That was January the 9th, 10th and 11th. It was January the 9th that was her birthday, when she would have been 100 if she hadn't died, as you said, in 1986 when she was 78. And it was 3 days of people talking, some of whom had known her, some of whom had just been hugely inspired by her. And I would say it was pretty much a celebration of a great woman. It was an inspiring time. So many women gave talks in which they said that Simone de Beauvoir had radically changed their lives, which is what I would say, which I did say.
And you have said, but tell us again, how did Simone change Hazel's life?
Well, I think like other women at the conference, there were two things. I read The Second Sex and I read her memoirs. And the two in combination showed me the possibility of another way of living a life. The thing was that in The Second Sex, which was published in 1949, but we who came of age in the late 60s, early 70s, during the time of the women's movement, read it again, or read it a first time. And her big thesis, the most famous maxim, is one is not born a woman, one becomes a woman. By which she meant, as a true existentialist, there is no such thing as nature. Excuse me. No such thing as human nature, no such thing as female nature. The whole idea of the feminine mystique is a mythology. It's an ideology tying us down by our biology. And what it actually makes women is society, programming, conditioning, socialization. And by the way, in 1949, when she made this point, it was long before those words were at all used. So she was the first one to come up with the idea that we are made into women. And then in her memoirs, she really shows a life which was so full it was as if she'd led three lives. And that allowed us, I think, to see what we could do ourselves with our lives.
She also lived in a certain way. She wanted to forge a certain relationship with Jean-Paul Sartre. Well, I suppose, you know, She wanted to forge a relationship as a woman with a man, and she was with him. She apparently has said that her relationship with Sartre was her greatest achievement in life.
Yeah, well, I would call it an achievement, and not in the silly sexist sense, but, you know, she made some very, very dramatic existential choices in her life. I mean, her books were really incredibly daring. But I would argue that her most dramatic existential choice, by which I mean really fundamental choice, was her relationship with Sartre. And you see, they met in the summer of 1929, and we've got to remember that this was a time when women didn't have the vote, women couldn't go to the most elite institutions. I mean, it was Sartre who went to the École Normale Supérieure. Simone de Beauvoir couldn't get into that. She went to the much more lowly Sorbonne to study philosophy. She did not have a dowry because her father had lost his money. But at that time, if you aspired to a good marriage to a bourgeois man, you better come with a dowry, however beautiful, however wealthy. And women didn't go into bars, they didn't drink alcohol in public, and above all, they must be virgins when they married. So here she was meeting this ugly little man. She described him to her sister as a very ugly man who was 5'1" and who wasn't offering her marriage. He was saying something very radical. He was saying, "I need my freedom." Well, lots of men have said that to lots of women, so what's interesting about that? What he said was, "But I want you to have yours too. And I'll be there to support you, to encourage you, to we'll share our adventures, we'll tell each other everything. We might be apart for a year or two in some exotic place having some passionate liaison, but we'll tell each other everything when we come home." Or
the telling each other everything. I mean, that was the theory, and that was what she understood presumably to be the premise.
Well, I think they did tell each other everything.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I remember reading your book and finding that he said something like, somebody asked him, do you lie to your women, and do you lie to the beaver? He used to call her the beaver, didn't he? And he said, "I lie to her most of all." Or
yes, well, he did, but you know, it was a
kind of comment.
It
was a truthish sort of relationship, was it?
Well, the thing was that at the time he said that, he was an old man, and he was hiding his whiskey bottles from Simone de Beauvoir behind his books because she was furious with him for drinking, because he was killing himself, basically. Sartre was pretty good at self-destruction. And she took on this rather ungratifying role at the end of her life of being the kind of mother figure who tried to stop him from drinking without success.
So he was referring to the drink, was he, when he talked about that telling of the truth?
Yes, because, you know, otherwise, about his affairs and so on, he really did tell her the truth. And what I'd like to say about that is it takes real guts to accept the truth. I mean, they had this idea as existentialists that they were going to be free and that they were going to accept each other's freedom, which is, by the way, very hard to do because they knew that they would be jealous. Simone de Beauvoir in particular knew this. But she said that jealousy is... you know, it might be a natural emotion, but it's something that we have the willpower to work on. And she did work on it. But you see, I think Sartre lied to his other girlfriends simply because they weren't capable of taking the truth. It takes a lot of strength and a lot of courage to take the truth from somebody else, especially if it's your loved one telling you that they're having an affair with somebody else.
He wasn't a very good lover, though, you say.
Well, I don't think he was the most passionate lover. That's true. So that at least Simone de Beauvoir said to Nelson Algren.
Her lover at the time.
Her lover, yes. So you never quite know with these comments, you know, the truth is.
So they had the courage, you say, to an imagination to invent a relationship outside the social conventions. And even after you found about the details of how they went about this, do you still hold that, you know, in the respect you did before you started this book?
Yes, I absolutely do. I've been disappointed, by the way, the reception of the book and the press at the moment. I mean, it was typical in France during the centenary celebrations 2 weeks ago. The press was reacting in the way that they have been doing with my book too, which is to adopt a kind of vaguely patronising tone and to sort of say things like poor old Simone de Beauvoir was a victim of Sartre. She cried a lot and, you know, perhaps she would have been happier if she'd been married to him. Well, I don't know where they get this idea from, certainly not from my book, because I really do show that she chose Sartre. She wasn't, in fact, in love with him at first. She was in love with another man. But it was a really rational existentialist choice that she realized that here was an incredibly exciting man who did love her, but who was offering her a really giddy prospect, which was freedom, which was to live her life as freely as he did as a man. And of course it took incredible courage, that pact that she sort of had with Sartre. It took her a lot more courage than it took him, because he was a man and, you know, men, he'd already been going to brothels and he'd already lost his virginity. He'd already had the kind of adventures that independent men can have, whereas she was going to be regarded as an easy woman, a loose woman, a scandalous woman. And what disappoints me is that, you know, people are still talking this way, you know, 100 years down the track from her birth.
Yeah, one French magazine described them as the Fred and Ginger of French existentialism. I mean, what does that say about the seriousness with which their ideas are held today in France?
Yes, that's what's disappointing me. I did write a book about their private relationship. I wrote a book about their relationship, so that in some ways you could accuse me, I suppose, of creating this, well, not creating it, because it's happened ever since they wrote themselves and ever since they lived themselves. But what I'm saying is everybody trivializes their life. They don't talk about, for example, their, you know, political engagement, which they really were committed to after the Second World War, when existentialism really became a worldwide vogue. And they decided that part of freedom was accepting their responsibility. Freedom comes with a kind of moral responsibility. And that as writers, this was to mean that they were to be politically committed writers who were to speak out about oppression and injustice and so on. And just to give you one example, during the Algerian War from 1954 to 1962, when Algeria was trying to become independent from France, the two of them, Sartre and Beauvoir, were among the very few French intellectuals who spoke out for Algerian independence and who talked in their magazine, Les Temps Modernes, Modern Times, about the torture that the French army was using. And it got them into a great deal of trouble. There were demonstrations on the Champs-Élysées with right-wing military people saying, "Kill Sartre! Kill Sartre!" And indeed, his apartment was twice bombed. On one occasion, if his mother hadn't been at the other end of the apartment in the bathroom, she would have been dead. Beauvoir herself had to go into hiding, because one way to get at Sartre would have been to kill her, so that her friends insisted that she had an apartment on the edge of Paris. So, I mean, what I'm trying to say is that they were courageous intellectuals who did speak out, and they paid a price for it. It was, at some points, their lives were in danger.
People often say she should be considered out of the shadow of Jean-Paul Sartre. But, you know, what do you think? I mean, her whole raison d'etre was so much tied up with him.
No, I actually think she is out of the shadow of Sartre. I mean, it's hard to talk about her without talking about him, and why should we? Because they really were a unit, in the sense that they really encouraged each other. But I think that she was, in her own right, a great writer. She won France's biggest literary prize, the Goncourt, for her novel The Mandarins. When she wrote The Second Sex, by the way, in 1949, she received just an avalanche of hate mail, because she took on a lot of very taboo subjects, female sexuality, lesbianism, abortion, and so on. And she was made into that ridiculous figure, you know, a feminist, that the French still today easily mock. And by the way, it has to be said that this 5-foot-1 man, who had suggested to her that she write about women and that she thought about what it meant to her to be a woman. It was his suggestion. And he showed complete solidarity with her, whereas the far more handsome Albert Camus hated the second sex. He told her that she ridiculed the French male.
Oh dear. Can't have that.
Yes, oh dear. So Sartre showed extraordinary solidarity. It's not easy to be a short man and to be walk in the streets beside the woman who the whole of France is pointing at and giggling at and calling a nasty feminist.
What about her beautiful bottom, though? I mean, what's the response to the shot of her bottom, which you've had in your book, which is a fine bottom, I seem to remember?
Yes, well, that's right. It was taken in the early 50s in Chicago. She was having a bath at a friend's place because Nelson Algren had an incredibly crappy little flat. I've seen photos of it. It was just really sordid. He himself washed his hair in the kitchen sink, but occasionally he had to go for a bath at the YMCA, we say, don't we, for men? And Simone de Beauvoir was taken to another person's bathroom where she didn't shut the door, and the photographer friend who took her there poked his camera through the crack in the door and had some beautiful shots taken. He took some beautiful shots of Simone de Beauvoir from behind. She was standing at the mirror doing her hair with her arms up. A shaft of light comes in on her lovely behind, and oddly enough, she's even wearing high heels and she's completely starkers.
So, as you do.
As you do, I always do when I'm standing in the mirror, exactly. But it has to be said that it is a very beautiful photo, and I included it in my book because I thought this showed a rather different kind of image of Simone de Beauvoir. We're so used to the blue stocking, turban, rather strict woman, and this is a photo of this photo shows her to be vulnerable, sexy, a real, you know, feminine woman. So but the thing was that the Nouvel Observateur put it on the cover of the magazine, and of course there were feminists picketing the Nouvel Observateur saying, why doesn't the editor of the magazine put his bare bottom on the cover, and why don't we see bare bottoms of Sartre and so on when it's his centenary?
I'm looking forward to that. Do we have pictures of Sartre's bottom?
Well, I think we need to be very grateful. Exactly. I think it's best that we don't. But it's true that it was a rather... It's one thing to put it in the middle of a book like I did amid other photos, and it's another thing to sort of slam it on the cover. But, of course, the Nouvel Observateur wanted to sell magazines, and they did.
But it is interesting. I mean, it's an interesting photo, isn't it? I mean, if you were a photo editor, you'd probably put that on the cover. But is that the only thing that she's being celebrated for? I mean, doesn't it say more about this age of celebrity and fame rather than respect for ideas?
I think it's that's the problem, isn't it? Underneath it said Simone la Scandaleuse. And she was scandalous. She was scandalous because she was daring in the things she wrote in her books. She took on endless taboos and you know, sacred subjects. She was scandalous in her sex life too, but to just concentrate on that is to trivialise her.
And just in the last minute, Hazel, Claude Lanzmann, one of her lovers, put on a bit of a performance which you describe as sulky at the conference that you were at. Can you just briefly tell me what he did?
Well, Claude Lanzmann is really hard to take, I must say. And everybody would say that. There isn't anybody out there who doesn't. But he was the first person to speak. He opened the conference on January the 9th. And even though he was once an incredibly handsome man when Simone de Beauvoir was with him, he is now 82 and is probably the person who has aged least well, whom I know at all. And he started by saying, I don't know what I am doing here among all you experts and specialists and university people. My only claim to fame is that I slept with Simone de Beauvoir under the same roof, in the same bed, for 7 years. And then he said it again, yes, in the same bed. And then he seemed to smirk. And then he read out her passage.
Well, this is a man who famously did a 9-hour program on the show, I remember. So he likes to string things out.
Yes.
Anyway, sorry, that was just occurred to me.
I was just going to say that you do realise, I mean, that was a wonderful film, sure.
Of course, we loved it. We loved it.
But you do realise that some of the people around Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre, including Claude Lanzmann, were groupies who were intimate with great people and who ever since have sort of lived off the capital, you know.
And Claude himself.
And abused their power. Absolutely, I see it that way.
So, all right then. Well, look, it's going to be a fantastic year. We've got our seatbelts on. the centenary of Simone de Beauvoir's work. Thank you so much, Hazel, for speaking to us on the book show.
Thank you, Ramona.
And Tête à Tête, Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre by Hazel Rowley is published by HarperCollins. You're on the book show. I'm Ramona Koval, and we're all on ABC Radio National. Sort of person who knows how many steps it takes to cross the road or how many stairs you have to climb to get to your flat? I am, actually. Well, that means you're a numbers person or a counter. And there are some people who are passionate about numbers to the point of obsession. They love the logic and order numbers give to the world. But there are others then who find them meaningless. But what's it like to write about numbers, to tell a story through characters who count? Two writers who've written about people with numbers obsessions are Rachel Robertson and Tony Jordan. Neither of them are counters themselves. Rachel Robertson is the winner or the co-winner of the Australian Book Review's Calibre Essay Award for her piece called Reaching 1000 about her autistic son who's fixated, one could say, on numbers and measurements. And Tony Jordan's debut novel called Addition has just come off the press. It's about Grace Vandenberg, who's witty, attractive, but numbers obsessed to the point where she can't make a decision if it disrupts her numbers routine. While both of these writers deal with the subject differently, one from experience, the other from her imagination, there's also a lot of crossover between their work. And they're both with me today. Tony and Rachel, welcome to the book show.
Thanks, Ramona.
Thanks.
Now, Tony, let's start with you. Can you describe Grace, your main character, to give us a sense of the world she lives in?
Well, in a number of ways, Grace is a normal woman in her mid-30s, but she's also a counter. And she might see it as a series of small quirks that she has. And in fact, she might think that the world would be a better place if we all counted a little. But as you said, she can't work, she can't drive because she can't take her eyes off the speedo in case it veers from 60. So it does have an enormous impact on her life, the counting regimes that she sets up.
Because she's fond of numbers that end, well, at 10, and multiples of 10.
Multiples of 10 is really her thing.
Give us a little bit of a taste of her because you've got a reading to do.
I do. It's Saturday. I wake at 5:55 a.m. I have 5 minutes to gather myself, then my feet hit the floor the second the numbers are all round to 6. I stand, 25 paces to the bathroom. Luckily, my legs are long for my height. If I had to face a 27 or a 28 so early in the morning, it would throw out my day. Brush my teeth? This is tricky. Each tooth has 3 surfaces, inner, top and outer, except for the front row, which only has 2 surfaces because the top is sharpened like a razor blade. There are 6 rows, top left, centre, top right, bottom left, centre, bottom right. Each surface needs 10 full strokes of the brush, back and forth. This means 16 by 10 strokes, 160. It takes a little while, then floss up and down between each tooth 10 times. Shower. When scrubbing each limb 10 times with soap, it's important not to be heavy-handed. Hair, washed every second day and counted out in the circles formed by each finger pressing against my scalp. 10 circles for each finger, then move to another place on my head. Repeat 10 times. The conditioner needs less, only 10 by 5. Out of the shower, dry myself with a towel from the top of the pile. Again, 10 wipes on each limb, 10 for the chest and 10 for the back. Wash my face. My face is divided into 5 zones, forehead, pale, wide, smooth. Each cheek defined by sharp cheekbones. One nose a little too pointy, and one chin prominent. The overall effect is attractive but sharp, like a Scandinavian maitre d' wearing underpants one size too small. Each zone needs 5 wipes with cotton pad to remove the cleanser. Repeat with toner, repeat with moisturiser, repeat with sunscreen. Dry hair, 100 slow strokes with the big brush under the dryer. This is the most difficult part because each stroke must be full and complete, right to the tips down the small of my back, yet gentle so that I don't end up with a halo of blonde frizz. The only variation to this is Sunday morning, when I also trim my nails and push back the cuticles and cut them and buff the nails 10 times each with each side of my buffer. There are 4 sides to my buffer: a file, a ridge remover, a smoother and a polisher. This too takes a while.
Boy, you can hear what sort of a girl Grace is. Rachel, in your essay, we start in your mother's kitchen. She was a mathematician. And then we shift to your son counting the house numbers on letterboxes. Your son has autism and, as you say, is passionate rather than obsessed about numbers. Tell me about your son and numbers.
Well, he's loved them since he first recognised them and counted up to 10 and then started counting on and on and on past 100, even though he was under 2 and we hadn't taught him how to count. But he seemed to just understand them and he seems to just relate to them. It's a little bit how he sees the world, Ramona. He doesn't do obsessive number things in the terms of having to brush his hair or touch things a certain number of times. But everything he sees, he can understand it through numbers. So when we go swimming, he wants to know how many metres deep the pools are. And when we go to shopping centres, he notices that every PowerPoint has a tiny number on it, which is something I never knew until he pointed it out to me.
So what is your own relationship to numbers, Rachel? Because you were brought up by mathematicians, so you were surrounded, presumably, by numbers, or did they not talk about numbers very much?
Both my parents were professional mathematicians, and they were fairly interested in numbers, but their maths, of course, is much more abstract. They're pure mathematicians, so it goes into sort of theoretical areas of maths, which, quite frankly, I have no idea what it is. But I've always been quite resistant to both maths and numbers, and I've always felt, I guess, growing up, I kind of understood myself to be someone who was not a maths person and not comfortable with numbers and who didn't count things like stairs or slices of banana, unlike some other people in my family who do tend to do that. And I don't remember phone numbers, and I don't notice number plates on cars. So I guess I've always been quite resistant, and then it was a big shock to me when my son started showing this interest.
Now, you've looked at Tony's book, Addition.
So
would you say your son approaches that attitude to numbers? Although when Tony was reading, I did remember that last night I woke up and I noticed that it was 123, and I thought, oh, 123, isn't that good? Instead of, oh, why am I up in the middle of the night? But you're not like that. But is your son at all inclined towards that?
Yes, he has some similarities. He often will wake, and he'll come in the morning. He comes in to me, and if he wakes a lot later than usual, he'll say, "I woke up late. You know, it's 6:20 instead of 6:01." So he's somebody who likes to wake up at 6:01. And it's very useful at times. We've never, ever been late for school because he knows what time we leave for school and that's when we go. But I think the similarities sort of run a bit deeper in that it's a way of coping with a very complex and confusing and troubling world. Mm. And the reason he finds it troubling might be different from Grace in the book. But some of the things that Grace says really reminded me of my son, how you can put systems in place, like time, things and depths and heights and numbers, but you can't plan for people because they don't follow systems properly. They're early or late or they do their own thing, and how troubling this is. And I think my son feels this. People aren't logical. They go off and do emotional, social things that aren't to do with logic and what he had planned for the day.
Tony, what triggered your decision to give Grace this literary tick? Because I understand you're not as bad as this, are you?
Well, I must confess to counting when I do the housework. I'm just the world's worst housekeeper. I find it so tedious.
What do you count?
I count dishes as I wash them and pieces of laundry to as I do them. So it was just a matter of extrapolating that and thinking, what if it wasn't just dishes? What if numbers controlled everything you wore and everywhere you went and everything you ate and an entire framework for an existence? Because the interesting part is that we all make these decisions. We all decide what we're going to wear in the morning, and it might not be the first piece of clothing on the left-hand side of the wardrobe, but somehow something in our brain says, I feel like that shirt today. And so it's more than just the numbers as a system. It's we all have a system, and it might be an unconscious system, but you never really know what other people are thinking and how they're making those decisions.
So how did you research the kind of person that she is? I mean, you extrapolate, but yes. I mean, there's more than that, isn't there? There's all kinds of approaches to number obsessions.
There is. I did a lot of looking on the internet on bulletin boards, people who had this kind of condition and people who were undergoing treatment for this kind of condition. And as Rachel says so wonderfully in her essay, what was really fascinating is that line between passionate and obsessive and how people define themselves. And that was really the interesting part for me, because it depended on which way you looked at it, which way you chose to look at it, and the way that other people looked at it that made that difference.
Did you ever think it was a bit claustrophobic writing about somebody who would only think in terms of numbers? I mean, reading your book, I mean, there are claustrophobic passages. And then when she meets her boyfriend, who's not actually obsessed with numbers, and he is much more free and easy, and that those sections are much more, they're written in a much more sort of free and easy way.
Yes, it was really fun playing with the writing style to keep it so tightly constrained in those bits where Grace is being herself, and it very controlled and much more open in the pieces where she's with Seamus. And that was really a lot of fun. I suppose that line between control and freedom is the same issue. And yeah, I really loved doing that. It was great.
Mm. Rachel, you're writing about numbers in a different way from Tony, from your own experience. But was it a challenge to write about numbers in this essay for you?
It was.
Some people think numbers aren't emotionally interesting. I'm not one of them. But what do you think?
I don't think they're that interesting, or at least I didn't. I think I'm learning a bit from my son. And I really enjoyed Tony's book because that gave me another way of thinking about numbers. But, I did find it hard, firstly because I realised there was quite a strong resistance in me to even thinking about this numbers thing. And secondly, I found I was writing things and it seemed a little bit boring. And in fact, one of the drafts of this I got some friends to read, and one of them said, look, I'm getting really bored with reading all these letterbox numbers. You've got to do something about it. And so I guess it's a challenge to try and convey that the sameness and the routine and the interest that my son has without actually boring the reader, but still getting across and expressing as a mother how sometimes confronting that is, but also how I was learning a bit from my son in the process.
Because how can anybody not be interested in the Fibonacci series? I mean, this is a description of the way, you know, seashells are made up, or flowers are, or petals, or like just about everything.
But you know, Ramona, I was told that sort of thing in biology, but it wasn't meaningful to me. And it's only through my son, when he will pick up a seashell and say, look, this could be a 6 or a 9. And then I look at it more closely and I have seen the beauty and seen some interest in those things. He's very good at bringing me to the concrete. I think a lot of us, or maybe I should just speak for myself, but often we live in the abstract world of ideas and thoughts, and he's very good at taking me to the concrete to notice things like leaves and petals and shells.
How much is it a sort of an inclination of his parents, his grandparents, the mathematicians? I mean, have you thought about a kind of a genetic predisposition to an interest in numbers?
Yeah. I mean, I've explored in my essay the sort of sense that there may be something genetic there, and that to me is comforting in a way, because I love my parents, and it's lovely to have something of them coming out in my son. But the other side of that, with a condition like autism, there's a suggestion that maybe the genetic connection has another component, that maybe some forms of autism maybe you know, there's a genetic predisposition. So that's an interesting idea in that it makes some people uncomfortable and not others. So that was something I am exploring in the essay.
Tony, Grace has to sort of seek help, doesn't she?
She does, yes. She makes the decision that she's going to see if there's a way to live a more normal life, and she gives it a try.
And what happens?
Well, it's very challenging for her, changing the definition of herself as someone with a problem instead of someone who just sees the world a bit differently. So, yeah, it's a very difficult journey for her to begin.
What did you learn? We've talked to Rachel about what she learned about her son's interest and an appreciation for numbers. What about you? What did you learn from writing Addition?
Well, I failed maths twice at university.
Twice?
And I've got...
At university? Yes. So that means you were pretty good at it up till then.
Well, yeah, pretty good at it up to then, but then went to university, discovered boys, failed maths, sort of is how it worked.
Except what happens at university is they don't teach maths very well, or they didn't, probably.
That's a
maybe
very
now
comforting...
it's very different, but I remember being in pure maths classes, yes, thinking, "What is going on?"
That's
down there?
That was exactly my feeling. So, I had to really learn a lot about how maths worked, and there's also some pieces on Nikola Tesla, the inventor.
Of course, I mean Grace is obsessed with Nikola Tesla.
Yes,
Tesla, who was a very strange man.
Yes, but he had threes. He was in love with threes, which Grace finds difficult to understand.
Because she likes tens.
That's right.
How could anybody like threes?
Even if they met, it would
be hard
to
understand.
It would be a mixed marriage, so I had to do a lot of research on him as well.
Well, very interesting. Thank you both for crunching numbers with me on the book show today. Tony Jordan's debut novel, Addition, is published by Text, and you can read Rachel Robertson's essay called Reaching 1,000 in the Australian Book Review. Thank you both for being on the book show.
Thanks, Ramona.
On ABC Radio National, I'm Ramona Koval. Now on tomorrow's book show, the woman who many people regard as the most important poetry critic in the USA, maybe even in the universe, Helen Vendler. Now, Irish poet Seamus Heaney calls her the best close reader of poems to be found on the literary pages. And she's the author of 19 books, among them studies of Yeats, Herbert, Keats, Stevens and Shakespeare. She's the A. Kingsley Porter University Professor at Harvard University, and she's a very smart lady, as you can imagine. So I'm looking forward to speaking with her tomorrow. You can hear this program again tonight at midnight or go to the website abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. Podcast us. Send us a note. Check out today's guest and book details there too. That's all from me. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.